Well, as I think many of you know, it's been a couple of weeks of birthdays in my family. And in the midst of three birthday chaos, on Shanda's birthday, in fact, Oliver suddenly noticed that something was wrong with it all. Driving home from daycare that day, he said to me, "But it can't be Mama's birthday. There's no snow." I explained how Oregon works, a little bit about climatology. Ollie could accept these laws of nature, but just for 2 days, until his birthday. "But there has to be snow for my birthday," he told me. "We make a snowman on my birthday." "Then Jesus needs to make snow for my birthday." And suddenly there it was, right? The dilemma every parent knows that they will eventually face. What to do when your child wants to ask Jesus for something that you're skeptical will actually happen. Like I suspect we all are in such moments, I was totally torn. Knowing that Ollie has really only seemed to see prayer as something we do at mealtime, in bedtime, or in church, part of me screamed, "Yes, this is the perfect opportunity to teach Ollie to pray spontaneously for the things he wants to ask Jesus for." And of course, another part of me cautioned, "But what are the chances it's going to snow on Wednesday? How are you going to explain that? What will it do to him if it doesn't snow?" But I mean, how do you tell your child, "Nah, don't pray for that because Jesus probably won't do it"? So Oliver prayed the most heartbreakingly innocent, gentle, trusting, first-time spontaneous words to Jesus. "Dear Jesus, please make the snow." And then, of course, Ollie's birthday came and it didn't snow. And although I knew I was overreacting, I felt a little panicky about it all. I started entertaining irrational thoughts like, maybe I should just cancel his birthday party and take him up to Mount Hood. That was actually Rich's suggestion as well, I think. Maybe I should convince him that yesterday morning's frost counted as snow. Maybe I should throw a whole bag of flour up into the ceiling fan when we get home. You know, reasonable parent thoughts, right? But why was I so panicky? Why do those of us who are parents feel like this when our children pray for things and don't get them? What's the big deal with that? Today, as we continue meditating on all of our unanswered prayers, not just the ones from our youngest family members, I want to put my finger on a foundational reason why moments like Oliver's and mine can make us as parents feel so panicky. Sure, on one level, we just worry about our kids being disappointed. And on another level, we worry about our kids being confused about prayer. But on a level even below that, I think we fear our children might conclude that there is no Jesus, or that Jesus is just far away and totally detached from their everyday lives. I think we fear that because I think we know that feeling ourselves. We know that we've prayed for things, things much, much bigger than for snow on a birthday, and not received them. We know that when we wait and wait and wait and wait and wait and wait and wait for Jesus, those questions creep in on us too. For example, if Jesus went around healing everyone who asked for it, if that was Jesus' big thing, then is Jesus really here with me if I don't get the answer to my prayer for physical, emotional, mental, or relational healing? So, today, as we continue talking about unanswered prayers on our journey towards Christmas, I want to explore the distance we can feel from God while we wait and wait and wait for Jesus to speak answers to our prayers. I want to invite us to draw on experiences of feeling distant from God amidst unanswered prayers to better immerse ourselves in what the people of God are feeling at the juncture in God's story that we're at. And I want to invite us to explore what this juncture in God's story might have to say to us about where we can find and look for Jesus' voice when our prayers go unanswered and Jesus feels far, far away. As we pick up our story today, we find the people of God right where we left them, 500 years removed from having their prayers answered. They've lived through the deterioration of their once prosperous home, followed by a violent takeover, followed by forced removal, exile, and then a fairly anticlimactic return home. They've been home for a while, but at best, they've had an unstable, unreliable independence characterized by infighting, and at worst, they've lived under brutal, occupying governments. In other words, the people of God are living on 500 years of unanswered prayer. Or, since they're technically home now, we might say they're living a half-answered prayer. A prayer so incompletely answered, it almost just makes a farce of their prayers in the first place. It'd be like praying for a house when you're homeless, only to be allowed to rent a spot in the home you grew up in, with a new owner enslaving you there, making you do all the housework. Your prayer might kind of be answered, but that answer feels like a joke right now. And so we find the people of God who feel like the joke of the region, the joke of the world, asking the same question we ask when our prayers go unanswered for a long time. Where is God? Why isn't God saying anything about this? Enter Elizabeth. Like the best of her people, she's still clinging to her frayed relationship with God. She's living blamelessly according to all the commandments and regulations of the Lord, is how Luke puts it. And like all of her people, she feels like a joke. She's old, quite old, and she has had no children. This can be painful for any of us, but as commentator William Barclay gives us a glimpse, this might have been particularly painful for Elizabeth in her time and place. He reminds us that in her context, not giving your husband a child was grounds for a man to divorce his wife. And on top of that, respected religious teachers claimed that not having a child actually excommunicated one from God. If having unanswered prayers makes us feel distant from God, imagine what it would feel like to have your faith community tell you that your particular unanswered prayer meant you had no connection at all with God. And so, Elizabeth's pain is deeply personal and obscenely public. The text eventually mentions that she endures disgrace among her people, which is fancy Bible talk for she's the punchline to the community joke. But then, Elizabeth's husband, Zechariah, is lighting incense in the temple when the angel Gabriel arrives. Zechariah is terrified. The angel tells him not to fear. The angel tells him some good news. You and Elizabeth are going to have a baby. What's more, this baby is going to do amazing things for God's people and this story you're living. Zechariah is understandably dubious. Gabriel doesn't like this doubting talk, though, so he says, you know what? You don't believe me? I'll give you a sign. You're not going to be able to talk until the baby arrives. And before you know it, Elizabeth is in her sixth month for pregnancy as Zechariah watches quietly. Then enter Mary. Mary is most definitely not praying that she's pregnant. She's young, and she's still just engaged. The story underlines this with a Sharpie by repeatedly saying that she is a virgin. Finding out she's pregnant is not going to be the answer to any long-held unanswered prayer for her individually. But while Elizabeth heard an answer to a personal unanswered prayer, Mary is about to live the answer to her entire people's unanswered prayer, to the world's unanswered prayer, and to the entire people's experience of feeling like a world joke. As with Zechariah, Gabriel arrives. As with Zechariah, Mary is terrified, but told not to be afraid. As with Zechariah, she's told that her baby-to-be is going to be a huge blessing to people. Except in Mary's case, he's going to be the big one. the king they've all been praying for, who will bring back David's throne and then reign, the angel says, forever. As with Zechariah, Mary doubts. There must be something more likable about her doubt, because rather than get ticked off like he did with Zechariah, Gabriel just tries to explain. He says, look, the Holy Spirit will come upon you and the power of the Most High will overshadow you. I'm not sure that's what we'd call comforting or label a clear explanation, but Mary immediately just says, okay, let it be. So, after Elizabeth has waited a lifetime for her prayer to be answered, and after God's people have waited 500 years, all of a sudden, God speaks. Twice in 6 months. The answers haven't fully arrived, but in the midst of God's people waiting, God speaks. So, as we engage Advent as an opportunity to meditate on what it means to wait for Jesus, especially when it comes to our unanswered prayers, let's take a few minutes to ask what we might take from this story. At first, I think we notice that God's message arrives in God's time, which might be kind of discouraging, since the literal application here is, God hasn't answered your prayer? Well, give it 500 years. But if we look more closely at our broader story, we'll notice that this is most definitely not the first and only time God has spoken in those 500 years. There have been messages, particularly from prophets, all along, pointing to this moment, guiding them to this moment. So, I think we can fairly say that God doesn't just speak to us every 500 years, and I think this big message tells us at least three things that we can apply to both God's once every 500 year messages and how we listen for God every day. Here they are. The first one is obvious, but in the midst of waiting for a long time, it can be the hardest to remember. Just keep living like you worship the God who speaks. Zechariah and Elizabeth had every reason to believe that the time for answering their prayer was long gone. Not only that, they lived in a culture that we're told would have given them every reason to feel totally disconnected from God. And yet, here they are at the beginning of this story on their society's spiritual garbage heap, in Zechariah's case, still serving as a priest, still lighting incense, and still working in the temple, and in both of their cases, still living according to all, as the text emphasizes, all the ways of God. The joke of their Jewish community and living in a larger society that would have been pressuring them to abandon their backward Jewish faith, we could probably forgive them for having already abandoned their faith. And yet, there they are, totally convinced their prayer will never be answered, sticking to their spiritual disciplines. And it is within that that God finally, unexpectedly appears. In fact, I want to add one more thing from Sunday school this morning. I think Carolyn said something this morning that takes us a little further. She said something about, if we wait for the huge sign from God, we may end up feeling like we're waiting forever. But if we, and my notes here are kind of small, if we wait together, though, we can be each other's reminders that waiting is worth it. And we're going to explore that more next week, too. But I want to reiterate that. It can sometimes feel like we're waiting forever. But if we support each other in that waiting and continue to do the practices of community and faith, we might hear more than we expect. Second, I want to linger on the word unexpected for a moment. Even when we wait expectantly for God, God's messages can be all kinds of unexpected. Surely, by his incredulous reaction to Gabriel, Zechariah has moved on to praying for other things. He's praying, but he no longer expects this to happen. But now, after all hope is gone, God answers. And surely, in this patriarchal society, one does not expect God to tell the male priest, by the way, something great's happening through your family, but you just zip it and let your wife bring it about. Or, in an even more unexpected progression of this, one does not expect God to move on to bringing the next message directly to a young woman, young girl, really, with only the briefest of mentions of her husband, who isn't even on stage for the big moment so far. Plus this. Whereas all of us hear this story and immediately think, if this young, pregnant, unmarried woman was me or my daughter, what would the neighbors think? God seems to give zero cares about the illusion of impropriety. Aside from the most minimal, only the smallest essentials clarification with Joseph in the Gospel of Matthew, God basically just says, yep, this is how it's going to happen. Not only all of this, but let's briefly notice that both Zechariah and Mary react with initial terror to God's message to them. When listening for God, we need to be ready for the seriously, even sometimes terrifyingly, unexpected. Third, God can speak to anyone, to all of us. Amidst the sparkling descriptions of Elizabeth and Mary that we find in Scripture and beyond, it can sometimes feel like God speaks only to the finest of saints. So it's easy to say, well, maybe God would speak to me if I was more of an Elizabeth or a Mary. Try living up to that standard, right? But to think that is to miss one of the key features of this story. This story is a story of repetition with few exceptions. So the Elizabeth and Zechariah story and the Mary story. Person minding their own business. Gabriel appears. Person is afraid. Gabriel says, be not afraid. Gabriel announces a pregnancy. Person doesn't believe. Gabriel provides a sign, and so on. But a huge difference should demand our attention. In story number one, all of this is happening to an old, old woman, well beyond childbearing years. In story number two, this is happening to a young, young woman who is still before her childbearing stage of life. This is the equivalent of a poetic technique used to say everyone by listing two extremes. Here's one of them from the Psalms, Psalm 139. Where can I go from your spirit, or where can I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, sometimes translated as hell, you are there. The point, of course, is not that God's only in heaven and Sheol, but that God is everywhere. We do the same thing when we lose our keys and say we searched high and low. We searched everywhere. In other words, this story is saying, who does God speak to? To the oldest childless woman and to the young unmarried fiancé. In short, to everyone. To close, I want to answer the big question that's been hanging in all of your minds since the beginning of this sermon. Did I, frantic parent that I was, cancel Ollie's birthday party to bring him to the top of Hood to see snow? Or did I at the very least chuck a bag of flour into the ceiling fan? Would have been fun, actually, but no. After noticing no snow that morning, we simply went ahead with the birthday party as planned. Ollie's prayer wasn't answered, and we went ahead with normal life. And at that party, a baby arrived. From the bakers, Ollie received a baby that, while not alive, actually eats and eliminates into a diaper. That night, with no guidance from us, Ollie prepared that baby a warm bottle, made that baby his own bed, fed him, changed him, and left Shanda and I with strict instructions to give that baby another warm bottle if he cried during the night. And then, the next morning, Ollie woke up without any instruction or comment from us and dutifully changed the baby's diaper to start the day. Amidst our normal plans, via an unexpected gift and reaction to that gift, amidst an almost frightening reminder that our boy is growing into a man, God said something that night. Not just anything. And not exactly what Ollie and I had prayed for, but God spoke. God spoke a small response to my prayers that Oliver will grow up to be a person who loves, nurtures, comforts, and cares. One who lives with God's presence close at hand. God speaks amidst unanswered prayers, amidst your normal plans. in unexpected, maybe even terrifying ways. Because God speaks to any and all of us. So, right now, where might God be speaking to you?